Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello and welcome to the Randomly Generated History Club, where three non-historians pick a year at random and try to learn things about it. I'm Will, and I'm here with my two friends, Ant and Anna.
Hi there.
Hello!
This year, we're talking about the year 1732, and I'd like each of us to give our three-word preview of what we're discussing today. Ant.
Lots of ships.
Anna.
Still got it.
I know your three words.
And my three words are lines on maps.
Oh, boy.
Good.
Great.
Okay, here we go. This week, I'm going to talk about the Penn-Calvert boundary dispute.
Oh, finally.
Which is also known as Penn versus Baltimore. Or Penn v. Baltimore, I guess.
Penn v. Baltimore.
Is the way it's often
said. Is it sort of Supreme Court ruling?
It is.
Yeah.
Penn versus Baltimore. It is it is a very long-running legal conflict. No, not, it's not Supreme Court, actually, because we're in 1732 and there was no Supreme Court.
Oh, that's right, because there, in fact, wasn't an America.
Right. Yeah, okay, minor detail.
Great.
Okay, so this is a very long-running legal conflict over who owned which bits of North America in the 1700s and 1800s, and it had some pretty significant implications for...
Spoiler alert, it was the indigenous people.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that they were not involved in the dispute.
We breezed right past that issue.
Yep, good.
But to clarify, I also agree with the position that they had a very legitimate claim. And it had big implications for the future United States and for the world, really. So it began as a dispute between William Penn and his subsequent heirs on one side and this guy called Charles Calvert, also called the third Baron Baltimore.
Mm. He sounds evil.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Baron is objectively the evilest sounding
Viscount's
title.
Pretty bad.
Viscount sounds mischievous, I would say.
And his heirs on the other side.
But Baron Baltimore's heirs.
Baron Baltimore's heirs. So Penn's heir, Penn and his heirs, Calvert slash Baron Baltimore and his heirs. And the overlapping, there was an overlapping set of charters of the land in colonial America that required a whole bunch of different attempts to mediate and to survey and resurvey. And then there are interventions from the kings and the courts and whole different and on loads of different levels over multiple decades. And subsequent questions over these charters have also been adjudicated by American arbitrators and, in fact, later on by the Supreme Court.
Okay.
But obviously only when there was one.
Yeah.
And the boundary dispute eventually shaped the borders of five US states.
Hmm.
Can you name any of them, Anna?
I can name several of them because Penn is the eponymous founder of Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania.
That is confirmed.
Baltimore.
Is in...
You know it.
Maryland.
Yep.
Nice.
Mississippi, maybe?
No.
Is that too
far? No, you're way off.
Then I would say maybe...
Florida?
Do we get into sort of Jersey?
Yeah. Which Jersey?
Old Jersey.
New?
Old
sorry. The newest one.
Correct.
Do we have a little bit of Delaware in the mix?
You do. You're 4 out of 5.
And I would say last one would be Virginia.
But
Virginia.
Which Virginia?
Regular Virginia?
No!
West Virginia?
Yes! Oh, oh, very good going, mama. Though.
Thank you.
Good knowledge of your country and the stuff that's in it. So it all started in 1629 when a guy called Samuel Godin sent agents of the Dutch West India Company to negotiate with a local Indian tribe. Sorry, quote, negotiate, unquote, to purchase land in Delaware. And then 3 years later, in 1632, King Charles I granted a guy called Cecil Calvert, who was a second Baron of Baltimore, a charter for land along the Chesapeake Bay. But the charter only granted the Calverts the right to, quote, uncultivated, unquote, lands.
Mm.
And the colonists arrived then in 1634, but they made no attempts to survey the northern border. So basically, we're off to the races.
Yep, yeah.
There's loads of ambiguity already.
Great.
And this then caused all the problems that followed.
They just want to, like, do you want to go see it before you buy? It's like, no, I'm sure it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine.
I'm sure it's all uncultivated.
This won't come back to bite me, I'm sure.
It's uncultivated by me and therefore uncultivated. So what followed were a whole load of disputes between the Dutch, the British, and the Swedes, who were also in the mix at the time.
You don't ever really think about them.
And all these people argued with each other over who had claimed what first. And that carried on for another 47 years.
Oh my God.
Until in 1681, William Penn was granted a charter for Pennsylvania by Charles II.
Okay.
And the new Lord Baltimore at that time, who was the son of the previous guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and by the way, this is like a multi-generational thing. We go through multiple Lord Baltimores.
Hatfields and McCoys, just like, carrying on the feud through the ages.
Yeah, this just goes on and on. And so they didn't object. At that point, the new Lord Baltimore didn't object to that grant, so long as Penn's land was north of the 40th parallel. So Penn sailed to the colonies, and in May 1683, he met Calvert to try to sort out who owned what. But the two men immediately disagreed on how the boundaries should be decided, including where the southern border of southern boundary of Pennsylvania was at all.
Was Penn famous for having not wanting any southern border and for it to stretch all the way down?
All the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. It's mine.
He was pretty aggressive.
Well, actually, he wasn't, because he was a Quaker, famously.
Oh,
so non-aggressive,
great oats.
Right?
Really good oats.
But potentially...
Did he get a bit fighty?
Potentially a pedant.
Okay. Well, probably.
And probably, I think Quakers can still be keen on earning money, can't they? So I think he was going for whatever was profit maximizing. And this meeting then between Calvert and Penn in 1683 marked the beginning... really, of the very, very long active legal dispute. So before there'd been ambiguity, and now they were like actively quarreling over what's...
Litigation. Was,
exactly. So fast forward another 50 years to the year in question, 1732. And
it still hasn't been resolved.
Oh, no way.
97 years of just like bickering about...
land.
So by this time, the descendants on both sides had been quarrelling about this, and neither side had been backing down. And it got more and more important because the colonies had grown hugely in this time, in terms of population, in terms of the economic, both the size of their economies now and the obvious economic potential for future decades
for
these things.
All the merch they bought.
A lot of merch.
But to clarify, like in that earlier period, 100 years before, you know, lots of these colonies were kind of tenuous, barely struggling to survive, and now they're very established, large, going places, colonies. And so it all came down to the fact that Calvert insisted the boundary should remain at the 40th parallel, while the Penns argued that it should be placed 20 miles south of Pennsylvania. That was really what it was all about.
Yeah.
And to put a stop to all this nonsense, the king convinced the two sides to come to a compromise.
10 miles?
And on May the 10th, 1732... Calvert and the Penns signed an article of agreement, which stated that boundary should be Pennsylvania's southern boundary, but then conveniently moved that boundary to just below the 40th parallel. and so everyone was kind of happy for a while.
Yeah.
But fast forward another 29 years.
Oh my God.
It just goes on.
Yeah.
And there were still some disputes because the maps used in that previous agreement had... guess what?
Not been surveyed.
Not been, yeah, not been,
again.
Not been accurately created.
I mean, they only had what, 142 years yeah. or whatever it is.
Right.
The thing is, their big mistake was they let the great-grandson of William Penn just draw the map with his crayon. Yeah.
So the maps were both poorly produced and then also additionally incorrectly marked.
Okay.
Oh, so, yeah. So enter two surveyors who were contracted by both the Penns and the Baltimores to go out, map the whole thing out mm-hmm. properly, and try once and for all to sort out who owned what.
Can
anyone guess the names
I
of those
I was going to say, I bet I know God. Their names.
Yes.
I bet one was called Mason and one was called Dixon.
That's correct.
Hey!
Charles Mason and Jeremiah Dixon
right, okay.
then set out to establish the boundaries, and they became known as the Mason-Dixon boundaries mm-hmm. And they were established on August the 20th, 1768, after they'd gone through their process of surveying the whole thing. And King George approved those boundaries in 1769, over 85 years after the beginning of the dispute. And and clearly, for anyone who knows really anything at all about American history, well, Anna, you described the significance of the Mason-Dixon line.
Well, it became quite important in the Civil War, right?
Yes. Yeah.
In terms of deciding what was the North and what was the South.
Yes,
yeah,
obviously.
Great.
And then arguably has... like,
yeah.
well, very significant cultural and societal implications
yeah,
stemming from that war, right? Ever since.
Really good barbecue south of there. Really.
Yeah, you've nailed it.
It's accurate.
That's top of the list.
That's it, yeah.
And then north is just...
approaches to barbecues.
Yeah. A lot of woods. Very woodsy. Did the British... learn from their mistake here in letting people have a voice in the negotiations when they later drew all the lines on all the maps in, for instance, the Middle East?
They did not.
Okay, great. Well,
and guess what happened after all of that to these lands and to the family's claims? Bear in mind, the king approved the boundaries in 1769.
Oh, yes. In fact, famously, several years later, the king was no longer
the king.
King of America.
Of America.
In this part of the world.
Yes. So after all of that, 7 years later, both families lost all claims to everything.
Of course.
That's amazing.
Wowzers.
And that was that. So they'd spent their entire time squabbling, and they got to enjoy it for a sweet, sweet 7 years.
That is so sad for them. I mean, to be clear, Penn did get his name in Pennsylvania, and the Baltimores did become the location of arguably one of the greatest TV shows of all time. So there is that.
I mean, there's a lesson in it for all of us, really. I think I'm actually going to give up my land dispute with my neighbor.
Yeah, life's too short.
Yeah, he's built his fence a little bit too much into my property. So.
Do you want me to come in and mediate?
I don't think you would draw the lines fairly in my favour.
I'll deal with this. Is he cultivating the land?
The Anna Will line would not suit me, I think, you know? I don't think so. Right, today, for my section, in 1732, I'm going to take you on a little trip to Spain.
Ooh,
so Spain, caliente. Yes, caliente. And picante at the same time. Mm. I don't know any of the words.
Okay.
So you're going to have to guide me here.
That's good.
But as a bit of a background, Spain at this time still had a fairly large influential empire. Okay. It was much weakened, not as coherent, but still very relevant and still an economic force to be reckoned with. It spanned parts of Spanish Netherlands, large parts of Italy, the Philippines, and much of the Americas. But in 1700, when King Charles II died, he didn't have any kids. Which is like just a running theme.
Yeah, we've
always
learned that that's a bad way to
kids.
Preserve your
bloodline. If you're going to be a king.
Yeah.
So this kicked off the wars of succession between the would-be heirs. So on one hand, there was Philip of Anjou, which was backed by the French, mm-hmm. and Charles of Austria, backed by the Austrians. And they had various claims and supporters from across Europe and all the different powerhouses there. So it's a pan-European sort of political intrigue and bit of a conflict with a lot at stake. The French wanted to seize control of Spain and have it as effectively as a vassal state. The British didn't want the French to succeed at anything.
Yep.
The Spanish wanted to stay Spanish. The Italians wanted parts of Italy back, etc. So there's lots of...
the Austrians were just having fun.
Austrians were having fun, yeah. But there was a lot of unrest and shifting of powers. And as such, like lands sort of changed hands this time. It was quite fluid as, you know, eventually Philip, you know, rose to the throne. But during this time, the strategic African cities of Oran, O-R-A-N, and Mers al-Kabir in Algeria were taken back by the Moors during the reconquest of Oran by the Bey of Mascara. So B-E-Y, a bey is a title of a lord in North Africa, and of Mascara, the Bey of Mascara, which is great. And his name was Mustafa Bouchalegem.
Maybelline.
Maybelline, yeah.
in the Bay of Mascara.
He took it via a siege. He cut off all the trade routes. They could only resupply by sea, and they capitulated, and he was able to take it. So it's great, great, great for them. Well done him. King Philip's now on the throne, and he wanted to make his mark, sort of resolidify the empire. And he decided that he was going to mount an expedition to get back these two lost cities. Very strategic trading routes there.
In Algeria. Presumably on the coast then. Yeah, okay.
And this campaign was funded very nicely because they had just had a very successful sort of effective sacking of Genoa, where they brought the fleet along and said, hey, we're going to bombard your city unless you give us loads of money. So they effectively bullied them into giving them like millions and millions of Spanish dollars. I can't remember the currency, but I'm assuming it's Spanish dollars. And so they mounted this massive, massive force with troops from all over, mercenaries as well as Spanish troops. There was about 32 battalions, which is approximately 30,000 troops, which include regiments from Ireland, Switzerland, and my favourite, the Walloon Guards.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, the Walloons were there.
Who are the Walloons?
The Belgians. Belgians, yeah, the elite Belgian.
Well, there was no Belgium, was there?
Well,
but
the Wallonian.
Yeah. Okay.
And they were all gathered in Alicante.
Yep.
Party town. Just a good place to
sure is.
So they're having mojitos. It was great.
But I've very small launched town. Many invasions from Alicante. In fact, I'm not allowed to go back there.
Yeah. At the head of this sort of expedition was Don Jose Carrillo del Albornoza. Oh, gosh.
You got some of those syllables I'm certain of it.
He was the Duke of Montemar, okay?
Okay.
We all know that guy.
Yeah, 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 that guy. And so the fleet set sail with 12 ships of the line, 50 frigates, 7 galleys, 26 galleots, 4 brigs, 97 zebeks, and several gunboats and bomb vessels, approximately.
Sorry, 97 zebeks?
97 zebeks, yeah.
Wow, that's
It's more than I would take.
I'd cap it at sort of 85.
85.
It's a lot to handle,
it's a lot of zebeks. How many sloops were there?
There were 0 sloops, according to this.
Oh.
But it was, well, there might be in the mix, who knows, because there's approximately 500 to 600 ships in total. And so vast was this fleet, a writer at the time stated, never before was the Mediterranean Sea covered in such a variety of flags, which I'm assuming were attached to the ships. Unless there's a separate like sort of thing going on as well there.
Yeah, that's the famous Mediterranean Sea quilt.
Well, they get to Algeria and they disembark after some bad weather, so they had to stand off from the bay and wait till the next day, so the Algerians are just waiting to ambush them effectively.
Yeah.
And the Algerians, they try to attack, but the firepower of the Spanish ship is just too great, and they cover the landing troops and they just, you know, decimate them before they can do much. Mm. And before midday, the majority of them had disembarked, so imagine just the effort of disembarking 30,000 troops onto the shore is just like, that is a long
queue.
It is a long queue. And they pushed up the hill and they were pretty decisive. About 20 to 22,000 men in total from the Moors were on the field. And the Grenadiers were really winning the day for them from the Spanish side. The firepower was just withering. And then they laid siege and took Mers el-Kabir, where the Algerians laid down their arms and negotiated, please just let us go back to, you know, Algeria main and we'll not fight you anymore.
Yeah.
And the Spanish then went on to take Oran fairly easily because it was abandoned. They just up and left.
Okay.
As was the palace of the Bey.
So that's perfect, right?
Yeah, it's great.
Great.
Well, not for the Algerians, but great for the Spanish.
So the Spanish waltzed in there and they captured the places back. They captured tons of artillery, innumerable artifacts of war, supplies. They had about 3 months of supplies they captured, so like the Algerians could have withstood a siege for a while at least. Lots of tinned beans, North African tinned beans, very, very tasty. Just tagines everywhere.
I love a tagine, just as a sidebar.
So what of this? I mean, like, you know, they've managed to capture these two. Spain's empire is a little bit back in the ascendancy again. The news spread to Spain and onto Europe.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And was celebrated widely. Obviously, some trepidation with the English because the French and Spanish were now a little bit connected.
Yeah.
But the Pope Clement, he was delighted. He was like, brilliant, we've got some more Christian cities in North Africa again. This is great.
Famously forgiving.
Yeah.
I prefer Pope Inclement, the Pope God of snow.
And then Philip of Spain. King Philip, he rewards the Duke of Montemore with the chain of the Order of the Golden Fleece. So him and the
Admiral. He made that up, didn't he?
Yeah.
He basically did.
You have the chain of the Order of the...
Golden Fleece, something like that, yeah. So Bey Hassan was not super happy about this, obviously.
No, yeah.
He regretted his cowardice by abandoning the city, and so he tried many, many times to retrieve it over the following months. So the Spanish basically left a garrison of about 6,000 troops there and then came back. But they were defeated every single time. Even when he massed 10,000 troops to try and take the city, he suffered up to 2,000 casualties. And as a consequence, the city actually remained under Spanish control till 1792.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So,
why did he give it up in the first place?
He's
just a coward.
Yeah, he's well. I mean, in fairness to him, there was 30,000 men, grenadiers included amongst them.
Yeah,
they had ships of the line. They had 97 zebeks.
That's true. You forgot how many zebeks they had.
That's a lot of zebeks. So you know, in the face of that withering firepower and number of flags,
a lot of flags. There's a fine line between cowardice and like reading the writing on the wall.
Yeah, yeah,
and
fair
being
one.
Like, all of my people are going to be slaughtered.
Yeah, history. Yeah. There are three options.
Okay, here we go.
The first option, which most people take, is that history won't remember them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The second option is that history remembers you for your extreme cowardice.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And the third option is you are Will Blythe.
Is that you're remembered for never, ever backing down under any circumstances whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even though you probably should have done every now and again. And there are no other options.
Yeah. Well, you can decide who you think Bey Hassan, the Bey of Mascara, was.
Loser. Wimp. Coward.
Decision made.
Decision made. All right. Thus pronounced the final judgment. Cool. Well, Will and I have done a bit of a Freaky Friday because he spoke
about... You swapped bodies?
We swapped bodies. I feel so powerful. I'm going to make a lot of great decisions. No, he spoke about what would become America. I'm going to tell a little story about somebody in the UK.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
In some of our harder episodes, we've often used the fact that someone died in the year in question as kind of a crutch.
People die every year.
Yeah, and it's a way to tick the box, appease the RNG.
Yep.
And today I am, in fact, doing that. But for once, the fact that my guy died in the year 1732 is actually the most remarkable thing about him.
Because he was so bland.
And no, it's because the hero of today's story, a man
Vanilla
named
Dave.
William Heisland, was 111 years old when he died.
Oh. No.
111 years old.
I am so intrigued how you're going to stretch this out over 10 minutes.
It is quite a brief story, but I just think I love this guy.
So they have his birth certificate and everything. Is this nailed on?
No. However, who needs a birth certificate?
They just cut his arm off and counted the rings, I'm assuming.
He claimed to be born in 1620 in Wiltshire. And people are just kind of accept that. There was a guy named William Hasland who is registered to be born in 1628 in Wiltshire. It's possible that that's the same guy, but then still he'd live to be over 100 years old. But let's believe him for what he says.
Yep.
William Hasland, 1620, Wiltshire. He first became a soldier at the age of 13. He fought in the English Civil Wars on the Royalist side, fighting for King Charles at the Battle of Edge Hill in 1642. And he was on the Royalist side for the entire Civil War, which ended about a month after his 31st birthday.
From 13 to 31?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, Aunt, that is, we have yet to scratch the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, no, he lived like three times that length.
Well, even of his soldiering career.
Wow, okay.
So when the war ended, even though he was on the losing side, he was permitted to go home because he was a fairly minor. He wasn't a big officer or anything. And he just kicked it throughout the duration of the English Republic. He was a royalist, so he wasn't, I'm sure, a big fan of Oliver Cromwell. Then his next war wasn't until 1688, when he was 68 years old. He fought in the Williamite War in Ireland, a war between the Jacobite supporters of James II and the Williamite supporters of William III. He fought in the famous Battle of the Boyne.
Yeah.
And he kept fighting until the war ended a few years later when he was 72.
Nice.
And you may think then he retired.
Yeah.
You would be wrong.
No way.
He was not done. In 1709, in the War of Spanish Succession that Ant's just talking about, William once again took up arms, and at the age of 89 years old, he was on the battlefield.
What, doing what? Like doing, seriously, he's not leading a charge. He's not being a grenadier. He's not on a horse.
Yeah.
He's not hoisting a flag.
Well, maybe he did all of those things at once. This
he was
is
just
a man.
Napping. That's what he was doing.
He was just like the mascot.
Yeah.
Hey, can we just, boys. Like, what going back, what was his first time on the battlefield?
His
13.
First time, yeah, he became a soldier when he was 13. I think his first big battle was in the Civil War in 42.
Right, okay.
So he was 22 then.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, like, even if he's like 7 or 8 years younger than he's saying,
he's still
there or thereabouts,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's still old. And at this point, like, it is absolutely confirmed that he is there and he is old and he's fighting. We have, maybe his birth date is wrong,
well,
but the fact that
did,
he's still around.
Marshall did this, didn't he? Like, anyway.
Yeah, well, so he...
Please tell me he stops.
His very last battle was also the largest one he ever fought, the Battle of Malplaquet. He was in the Royal Scots Regiment, which had the distinction of having the oldest and youngest men on the field, because William was 89 and there was a Private McBain.
Private fetus.
There was a Private McBain who apparently fought the battle with his 3-week-old son strapped to his back.
No, he didn't.
Great parents.
I mean, it's great body armor, really.
It's great,
is a fact. That was made up like 25 years later as a thing to say about the battle.
You know what? I'm so tired of you calling my facts, my hard-earned facts, into question. Everything I say is true.
I believe you.
Thank you.
That's baby lazy.
That's why I like you
private,
more.
Private fetus was there.
Private fetus. Private McBain. So the war ended, the War of Spanish Succession ended, and William did finally retire. And
I think it's a damning indictment on just daycare for children as well.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's always been a problem.
It's it's absolutely been a problem.
Oh, I've got to take him to the office today.
And my wife couldn't get off work, so
are you sure?
I'm take him to the battle.
Yeah, it's a battle day today. You really sure?
No, I really couldn't work it out. Babysitters wasn't available.
Yeah. He's pretty chill. He'll just be on my back. The war ended. William finally retired. He was granted a pension of 1 crown a week.
Nice.
I don't know how much a crown
for
is
for his 90
now,
years
but,
of service. Yeah, it doesn't
does
seem like a lot.
It seems sufficient for his 90 years of service. He was the last survivor of the English Civil Wars. Oh. And then he became a Chelsea pensioner. And for listeners outside of the UK, the Chelsea pensioners are residents of the Royal Hospital Chelsea, which is a retirement home and a nursing home for former members of the British Army. And at the hospital, you could either be an out pensioner, which means you receive your pension but don't live in the hospital, or an in pensioner, which means you give up your pension in exchange for a room and board and clothing and everything. Notably, the Chelsea pensioners have to be free of any financial need to support a family or a spouse. And until 2009, they had to be male. And that's why, back in the year 1723, William Heisland was forced to leave the Royal Hospital Chelsea when he got married at the ripe old age of 103 years old.
What a legend.
I know. Still got it.
103
like... years old, presumably to, I mean, you would have to assume a younger woman.
I'm sure. Yeah.
He outlives her.
Are you kidding me?
She dies. He returns to Royal Hospital Chelsea and becomes an in-pensioner again because he no longer has a wife. And then shortly after that, in 1732, he dies in the hospital at the age of 111.
Wow.
But not before sitting for an oil portrait that still hangs in the museum of the hospital. And by my calculations, he lived through the reigns of 8 different English and then later British monarchs, as well as Oliver and Richard Cromwell. He saw dynasties come and go. He saw the Republic and the Restoration, the Acts of Union, pretty consequential stuff. And he's buried in the Royal Hospital burial ground. And I really liked the inscription on his tomb. And I'm going to read the whole thing for you here. Here lies William Heisland, a veteran, if ever soldier was, mm-hmm. who merited well a pension, if long service be a merit, having served upwards of the days of man, ancient, but not superannuated, engaged in a series of wars, civil as well as foreign, yet not maimed or worn out by either. His complexion was fresh and florid, his health hale and hearty, his memory exact and ready. In stature, he exceeded the military size.
What an odd thing to have. Sorry, go on.
In strength, he surpassed the prime of youth. And what rendered his age still more patriarchal, when above 100 years old, he took unto him a wife. Read, fellow soldiers, and reflect that there is a spiritual warfare as well as a warfare temporal.
Yeah. That's quite nice. It's not exactly as pithy as Bismarck's, I'd say. But, you know, it's still very nice. Yeah.
It's quite... quite lengthy, but you know what? If you make it to 111, you deserve to have as many words as possible on
it's
your
tomb. Spiritual warfare as well as temporal. It's quite nice.
It's quite nice, right?
Poetic.
That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So that is just a fun little story about a man, William Heisland.
I love people whose lives span eras that you don't usually connect.
Yeah. Mm.
I think that's really fascinating. I was just Googling. I was trying to find an interview, which maybe we can link to it or something.
Yeah.
But there's a really interesting interview. So it is. There was a game show called The $64,000 Question, and in the original one of the original episodes of this thing from the early 50s, there was an interview with a guy whose father had fought in the Revolutionary War.
Wow.
Because he was so it's just astonishing.
You just don't join these up together.
Totally.
His father was like a 12-year-old drummer boy at very famous battles in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah.
And then he didn't have him until like his 70s. And then this guy was 90 in his 90s.
Yeah.
It's just amazing how
it is really cool. And it's like that's easier to do in America because America is so, you know, young. But like, so this guy was born in living memory of Queen Elizabeth I.
Yeah.
And died in the reign of, I think, George II, or maybe even George III, which is, you know, and dynasties later.
And even in my family, my father was...
Weren't you at Waterloo?
No.
You were at Waterloo.
Well, I was at Waterloo, but then I'm 740 years old.
Yeah.
Actually, my father fought with Alfred the Great.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, he had me when he was 600 years old.
Your father was Ethelwulf.
Ethelwulf, that's right. King Ethelwulf.
King Ethelwulf.
Great.
You're not only podcasting royalty, you're also
actual
royalty.
Yes.
That was a lovely story.
And I will have my vengeance.
In this life or the next. So that was just a nice little story about a very, very old man. Well, thanks so much for joining us. That's everything you'd ever need to know about the year 1732.
Yeah. And before we go and get the random number generator, just one small plea to our fans. Please do rate us on whatever platform you listen to, whether that's Spotify, Apple Podcasts.
Good Pods. On Good Pods, you can rate the actual episode itself, which I think is quite cute.
That's quite cute.
Yeah.
Or if you are one of our many members that get this by audio cassette, just return the self-addressed envelope.
Messenger Foxes
with 5 stars. All that's left to do now, though, is Will.
Yeah, and on that, I think if you're like the vast majority of podcast listeners, including like me, you just listen to the podcasts and you don't actually go in and rate it. And it is a bit of an effort. But just, you know, go and do that now. Like right now, just go and just jump in and do the 5-star thing. And then
we'll wait for you.
And it just helps people find us. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, right. So
you're doing your proper job, please, Will.
Sorry. Yeah.
We need a random number.
Oh, yes, of course. Okay.
Random number generator is actually steaming right now. I think it's overheating and you need to boot it up.
Yes. Okay. It is booting. And the next year is...
Mm-hmm.
1985!
That's so modern.
Wow.
That's pretty cool.
That's almost too modern.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
Okay.
That's going to be like...
Shotgun the history amazing. Of synthwave music.
I'd like to talk about Devo.
Devo?
Yeah, Whip It. I don't know why that's the first like 80s band I thought of.
I don't know what you're talking about. I was born in 2005.
The only thing I can think of is Michael J. Fox and a DeLorean.
Yeah.
And Home Alone? Was that around that time?
Home Alone?
No, that's like 92.
Oh, yeah. God, yeah. I'm so bad at this.
You're bad at this. 1985, that's going to be a banger. That's like, that is amazing. I'm so excited.
Should we all dress up in 80s attire for
Yeah.
it? Brilliant. I'm in.
I'm putting my hair into a side pony as we speak.
You can finally wear my triple denim.
We're so excited by modern years.
I know.
And so disappointed
I don't want to hear one more thing about the bloody Safavids.
Yeah. You know? Especially just like obscure
What's
years.
What's going to be
like,
great is when Ant still talks about Rome.
The Medici's in 1985. Pope John
happen.
Paul II.
Yeah.
Legend.
Brilliant.
Oh, great. Okay, we'll see you then.
See you in the 80s.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.